Intentional growth is it's purposeful. It's having a very clearly defined end goal and striving towards that end goal with your very detailed plan day after day after day until you hit it.
Welcome to Intentional Growth, a show that teaches you as a business owner and entrepreneur to view and run your company like a financial asset, which will allow you to enjoy work, create wealth, and make an impact. This mindset will help you focus on building a more valuable business and give you the choices to grow, acquire, reinvest, or exit and live the life you plan for, all with intention. And now here's your host, Ryan Tansom.
Welcome back, everybody. This is episode 3 of our mini series of demystifying business valuations. And I have two amazing guests in store for you today. And we are going to be talking about strategic transaction value when there's a buyer and a seller that come to the table and there's a purpose of the deal, whether it's emotions or strategic reasons that a third party would want to buy your company and how that will impact the value of your business and a premium. Because the buyer or the seller wants or has a plan to do something with your company that's above and beyond the intrinsic financial value. If you've not caught the other two episodes, the first episode in this mini series with my partner, Pat and Hobby and I, where we lay out the groundwork for a lot of concepts on business valuations, from where the multiples come from, how to normalize your EBITDA and why that matters, and then how the value of the business is based on the risk of its cash flow. And that's the intrinsic value. And then the second episode last week, we talked to Dave Deal, the CEO of Prairie Capital, that specializes in ESOPs as well as management buyouts, and really gives us the perspective from a financial buyer that has to put a deal together that is going to be valued based on the risk of the cash flow, what he was seeing and how he interprets the value of a company and how he interprets risk as it relates to cash flow. And so that all leads us up to today, where if you want to take your company to market to a third party, you're going to be getting a bunch of different buyers from private equity firms and strategic buyers that are going to have a reason that they want to buy your company. And they bring those reasons to the table, and it reflects it in the valuation, the deal structure, the conversations, how you normalize your EBITDA. And I have two guests today that are just wonderful for this topic. I have Ted Schluter on the show again. He is the author of Branding for Buyout. It's also a business, and he's also the founder of The Grist. And his background is in marketing. He'll give you his whole background in a second when we open up to the interview. That helps people position their company to get maximum value when they go to sell because of the brand perception, the strategic perception in the buyer's eyes. And then we have Eric Coonrod on the show, who is the founder of Integral Capital Partners, investment banker for the last 15, 20 years. And he is going to be talking about why the buyers, with the purpose of the buyers, intent to buy companies, the various reasons, and then how they view deal structures, EBITDA, the conversations. And the reason that I had them both on the show today to talk about the strategic transaction value is because it's unlike anything I've seen, where you have the strategic marketing piece married up with the financial piece. Because if you think about it, every business owner can tell a story about what can happen with their company with a strategic buyer once they buy it. And then the next question is prove it. So you essentially have Ted, the marketing strategy guy, and then you've got Eric, who is the finance investment banker. And when they marry it up, Ted calls it alchemy, and they're reinventing how to position your company in the marketplace to a third party to increase the value of the company based on the purpose of the deal in the eyes of the buyer. I'm very excited for this episode, and it puts it in context because you can know the value of your company while you own it, but at some point there's going to be someone across the table, and you want to make sure that you get everything you want from the terms and the conditions and the value because you understand why someone wants to buy your company. So I will let Ted and Eric give their backgrounds in just a second. And again, if you want to understand how to organize your financials in the way that you can run your company like a financial or like as a financial asset, go check out the Intentional Growth Assessment. Otherwise, without further ado, here is my interview with Ted and Eric. You ever found yourself in your office after an executive meeting and you're sitting there going, I have huge decisions to make, whether it's hiring that next key employee, buying that next piece of machinery, buying a building, launching a location or product or whatever it might be. And you're sitting there going, is this the right decision? And then you think back about the original vision you had when you started the business or the vision you have right now that you know is possible in the marketplace. And you sit there and go, How do you know, and how do I know that what I'm doing is the right thing, when realistically you have the option to just take all the money home and solve for annual cash flow and essentially just have a job that's kicking out a lot of cash? The reason that you would do all those things is because you want to grow a company that's worth a bunch of money that gives you the freedom of choices to do what you want long term. Whether that's take a back seat and be a passive investor, whether that's sell part of it or some of it, essentially just have as many choices as you want. But what we find is that most times entrepreneurs and business owners are solving for annual cash flow because they don't know how to measure and monitor the value of the business and where they are today and how what they're investing in doing is growing a more valuable business and how to measure that into the future. And I had experienced the exact same thing. I ran a family business that was doing 20 million in revenue, 100 and some employees. And my dad and I had this constant conversation back and forth about what we should be doing and where we should be going, but we never really knew whether what we were spending our time and money on was making us progress towards that eventual goal of having a valuation that we wanted that gave us the choices. So then you have to sit there and go, maybe I should just take the money home, or I should just hope and pray. That is exactly why we created this financial assessment, because if you organize your financials in a certain way, and we have this financial foundation with four components, you take this assessment, it's 22 questions, you don't need your financials, and at the end result of it, there's a results page where Pat, my partner, and I walk through five videos to show you a case study of what good looks like and how to actually project out the future value of the company and how you can make the decision's clear today to say, if I do these things, what's the impact on cash flow today, my ability to fund my growth, take the distributions, pay for taxes, all while staying in line, progressing towards the valuation that I want. So go take the assessment below, and I hope you enjoy. Eric and Ted, how are we, guys?
Hello, Ryan.
Hey, Ryan, how you doing?
So we got three of us who all like to talk a lot on a three-way podcast. This is going to be a lot of fun. We're going to be watching each other's facial expressions to see when we should jump in. Ted, I'm glad you're back on the show. I really enjoyed our conversations, and you have met Eric in the last, well, I'll let you guys tell your story, but you know, Ted, you were on talking about your branding for Bio, and on episode three of this little three-part series, I thought what you were doing was wonderful and wonderfully placed right in this context. And you told me about some of the stuff that you're doing on with Eric recently. And so why don't I'll just tee it up to you guys to give a little bit of your background. And then once you guys give a little bit of your background, I want Ted, maybe you to talk about branding for Bio. And then Eric, you can talk about, you know, why you guys decided to partner up. But Eric, let's start with you.
Okay. Great, Ryan. Thanks. I appreciate allowing me to speak about Integral and about this subject. And Ted, thanks for the intro, man. My name is Eric Coonrod. I've been a banker for about almost 20 years. Started my career at Deutsche Bank in 2003, New York City. Worked there for a couple of years. I'm a Midwestern guy from St. Louis, so New York's fun to visit, but for me, not to live there, man. So that's why I didn't see any of it anyway. I was in the office all the time, so I didn't even experience New York, but great experience, second to none. Did that for a couple of years and moved out to Los Angeles in 2006 and pretty much have been doing, consumer M&A. Well, not just consumer, but, you know, industrials, consumer, healthcare services, but mergers and acquisitions, investment banking for the last 16 years. And during the recession of 08 and 09, I worked for myself buying and selling a couple of different companies for other people. So that's me and that's my background. And now, by the way, now I own Integral Capital Advisors. I started my own investment bank June 2nd of last year. We're 13 months in. Been an interesting 13 months owning your own business. Banking is difficult on its own, much less when you own it and run it. That's even more interesting. And then now we're going to be a merchant bank. So we've got the okay about 2 weeks ago to start the $50 million fund. It'll be a very small little fund that will go hand in hand with the investment bank, and that's called merchant banking. So I can actually advise people on to raise capital or to buy, you know, buy or sell, but I can also put money to work with it as well or roll my fee.
Oh, super cool. Yeah, I didn't know that. That's awesome. And so, Ted, I want you to give a look, because you've been on for Branding for Bio. We'll put that in the show notes for everybody, so if they want to go back and listen to that episode. But why don't you give an overview of your background, kind of the setup of your structure, Branding for Bio, and then we'll hear a little bit about how you guys decided to form up and how that relates to when you're selling to a third party and the purpose of the deal and really what the whole Branding for Bio philosophy is.
You bet. And thanks again for having me back on the show, Ryan. And of course, I'm thrilled to be on this show with Eric. So my quick background, I started my career on the creative side of advertising back in the 90s in the Boston market, and worked for some big advertising and marketing companies in both Boston and New York. And when I was in the late 20s, I asked my dad, I'm like, hey, naively, I guess, I think I can do this stuff on my own. I want to go start my own business. Should I go back to school? He's like, nope, just go do. Of course, it was way more challenging than I ever could imagine. The school of hard knocks is what I've lived for the last 25 plus years as a small business owner. And present day, I am the CEO of a marketing agency now based in Boston and on the West Coast because of a partnership with Eric called The Grist. And The Grist is a marketing and branding company, but what we've built over the last roughly decade is a proprietary methodology called Branding for Buyout, which is where the kind of juicy, interesting stuff, I think, on this conversation happens, where I think marketing and branding has never had a seat at the M&A table. And what we've been doing is somewhat of working in a silo until I met this highly innovative, dynamic guy named Eric Coonrod, who was willing and open to challenge what I would call the typical sell side process and to unlock new ways to create value for the entrepreneur, founder, owner, operator.
I love it. And so what I want you to maybe give a little bit more context on the Branding for Buyout. And after you do that, Eric, if you could explain like what intrigued you about what Ted's doing, because before when I talked to you, Ted, last year, you know, you were just doing this on your own and you and I were talking about kind of some of the archaic things as it relates to the investment banking process. And, but you weren't sitting next to someone that also did it. You were kind of just, you know, pioneering your way into that field. But why don't you kind of give us the overview of like what the Branding for Buyout methodology is. And then Eric, I'd love to hear why you decided that made sense to hitch a wagon with.
Yeah, without repeating from the last episode, I would just say this. Marketing and branding has always existed to sell more product, service, or technology to a customer. That's its whole sole goal should be that, to increase sales and help companies grow. But after branding myself out of a job repetitively over 10 years, I realized like an epiphany that there's actually a new target audience that I had never focused on, which is the buyer or potential buyers of a business. And when you think about a new target audience, you have to run a bimodal track. You have to run track one, as you always have, sell more product or service or technology to increase sales, mandatory. But there's another work track where we now intersect with Eric, which is, if you know who the potential buyers could be, you can actually position the brand in aggregate, not only so it's appealing to customers, but it's so it's appealing to buyers and what they want to buy. And they don't want to just buy you for who and what you are today. They want to buy the future of what your business is going to be for them. And when you understand that, it unlocks this entire universe of value creation that's never, you know, existed before. And I'll just go one step further and I'll pass the baton over to Eric. What I found is that the current process, the sell side process, is pretty linear and, you know, really focused on the numbers and the operations and the sales, and it is usually isolated to like a one pager and a sim and a process. But imagine if you knew who the potential buyers were and you could affect change across the entire brand. How would that affect value creation and maximizing exit potential, especially when you have an absolute expert like Eric who knows how this game is played and is truly, you know, an innovator in his own right in that capacity? It kind of is almost like what a taxi cab used to be before Uber. The taxi cab still gets you from point A to point B, but there's a faster, better, stronger way to do it that unlocks more value.
And right before you jump in, Eric, I was thinking about this comment you meant Ted, or you said Ted, and I don't remember if it was your book or the last podcast we did, but you're like, so you build this whole business for your whole life, and you know, most entrepreneurs are the best storytellers for their brand and what they're doing. And you're going to have, you know, 20 years of telling stories. You hand it over to a bunch of spreadsheet junkies who are supposed to tell the story right for you. You're like, and I'm like, oh man, do I relate to that? And so now that you were able to talk a little bit more smack about investment bankers, but now we got Eric on the call here. So Eric, obviously you stuck out to Ted. So I'm curious on how you guys met and what attracted you from your history in investment banking to what Ted was doing.
So, well, I met Ted with a mutual friend named Amir, who worked for Morgan Stanley. And he, Ted and I hit it off immediately. He's an awesome dude. He's a wrestler, you know, crazy enough to be a wrestler. Cool guy, unbelievable energy, super smart and successful. So right away we hit it off. He's this guy, two guys, almost like brothers. Right away we had dinner in Boston one night. Ted just hit it off. And then I started learning about
By the way, sorry to interrupt, but I would never get in the octagon with Eric because he has way more skills than I do. Mixed martial arts. This guy's special.
You guys will break me in half. So we got that covered.
Yeah, that was a long time ago. But no, we hit it off instantaneously. And that's the first part. If I want to do business with somebody, I got to like them and respect them and trust them. So that was almost, you can't trust someone from a first meeting, but off to a good start, man. Just a great guy. And he was talking about his business and how he markets his businesses, branding for buyout before they're sold. And he gave me this example of how one of his clients, he thought about the big client. He went to a pitch and said, I'm going to put the buyer on their plane about, you know, you, and then like they acquired you. And that was brilliant. So you're making the potential buyer think about what the client, the seller would look like underneath, you know, their infrastructure. That was brilliant. We started talking and it got me thinking, like you just said, Ryan, I can write a pretty decent sim in position. I'm not a marketer. None of my guys are marketers. I think we're right brain and Ted's left brain or vice versa, whatever. But we can tell a good story, but you've seen sims. Even the good ones aren't great because we're not marketers. So with Ted and his team, they create campaigns, marketing campaigns to what? To increase revenue, to increase profitability, to increase market penetration. And I need that. I need that for my clients. And what I do is I'd like to get people in years in advance. If you're going to sell your business, most people sell their business, I'm going to sell. Well, you haven't prepared. No tax planning, no estate planning, no legal planning. So I started thinking about it. Well, what if we got Ted should be in there way ahead of time to help the market? And he that's what he does. He told me what he does. I thought, yeah, get in there. Let's say you're going to sell in 3 years. Get Ted in there now and his team to create a marketing campaign that takes it from 20 million of revenue to 100 million of revenue. By the time I sell it, that's fantastic. Not only that, is that he can actually position, he knows that with he and Leaf and Mary, they know they have a lot of information about buyers and companies. They can figure out their sweet spots. We can take a sim, you know, an offering doc and make it for this buyer and one for this buyer and one for this buyer that speaks to them. If you do that, you mm-hmm. can really increase the value of the sale process and everybody wins. And he's way ahead of his time. I thought, this is brilliant. I got to talk to this guy more.
Well, and what you guys just described and is what I want to continue to unpack, because the previous two episodes in this series was, you know, demystifying valuations, kind of like here are the components that they work from normalized EBITDA, the multiples and how to view your company as an asset, even though you own it. And then we talked about intrinsic value of selling to a financial buyer prior. But when you talk about selling to the third party, private equity, strategic buyers, whatever, I mean, a lot of people can envision the strategic buyer like of their company, like, oh, these people would need us for these reasons. I mean, I hear that all day long. You know, it's a little bit more ambiguous, the private equity folks, because if the owners don't always know where they are. But there's this, when we talk about intrinsic value versus the transaction value, the strategic transaction value, having the purpose of a deal and having a premium or a discount from the financial discounted cash flow valuation. And you're really focusing on the purpose of the deal. And this is like the big, why would a buyer want to buy your company? And you're just positioning it that way over a period of time. And I think about guys like with our business, I was telling you this on the prep call, we had two offers in strategic buyers, but one, it was a financial valuation because they wanted to keep us as is in the marketplace. The other one, it was a roll up, a tuck under. So it was a maximized purchase price, but we had positioned ourselves very like elementary compared to what you guys are doing against like what the narrative was. So like what, Ted, you hit on something that was crucial of like crafting that narrative over time with the buyers. Like how, explain that, because you got to be selling more products and more services and building value over time. But what does that mean of positioning yourself You also use the word category that it might not resonate with everybody. Why don't you kind of explain a little bit more about what you'd mean by that?
Yeah, and some things to unpack there, but I'll break it down as succinctly as I can. One thing we do in conjunction with Eric is analyze past M&A activity in a particular category. And I'll use B2B tech as an example, because a lot of people think B2B tech is hard to do and, you know, it's feeds and speeds. And the way to win in B2B tech, by the way, is by humanizing the story and getting away from all of the tactical stuff. But as a very specific example, if you start to look at M&A activity in a particular B2B tech space, people might be buying platforms. People might be buying AI. There are certain key words and concepts that the buyer wants to buy, not necessarily the customer. So if you know what the past activity has looked like and with successful M&A activity, it can give you clues on what particular buyers might be looking for. There are other ways to enhance the value too, and I'll give you two more kind of tactical examples. If you're a really good marketer these days, especially with digital, you've built a dashboard, Google's Data Studio or other, and that dashboard is keeping track of all your metrics on how you market the business to the customer. Well, that dashboard, depending on how robust and intuitive it is, can actually be an asset to the buyer. They can be like, wow, you have to complete control over your market. We can see the levers you're pushing and pulling. That's something that we see great value in. And, you know, that can be a great tool.
Real quick, Ted, on that note too, though, when that's done so well, the buyer might see that and think, I could put that in my infrastructure and make a fortune. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and to build off of what Eric just said, back to the buyer doesn't want to buy who and what you are today. They're investing in the future. So another thing that we do is spend a lot of time with the C-suite or founder or CEO, and with Eric's help, and this is really where the cogs need to mesh, without spending the time, money, or energy on that next gen of technology or that next gen of product, you can actually brand the future, brand the roadmap, and think about what the buyer wants to achieve over the next 2 or 3 years and map that out as an asset. And then they're not trying to strategically guess with you what the future of the business and the brand is going to be. You're actually showing them in real time what it could be.
I love it. That's so well said. And I'd love to hear from both your perspectives and your skill sets. What does that mean? Because that means something different for your role, Ted, than it does from your role, Eric, right? And so can you guys explain from both of your perspectives what that actually means?
Yeah, I mean, maybe I'll go first just to keep the narrative going. So for one particular brand, I won't name names, but for one particular brand, they're in a competitive situation looking to sell. We knew that they needed, you know, we needed to create some urgency and, if possible, competitive tension. And by the way, with digital marketing, you can basically get into the ecosystem and brain of a buyer and put your content in front of them, if nothing else, just for awareness. That's some special black box.
I love that. But give an example of that. Because that's brilliant.
Yeah, you can geofence an office space, and if someone has location activated on one of their apps, you can grab their IP address and start to serve up content. It's, you know, there's...
It's directly to the buyer of a future business. I mean, like, people aren't thinking about that stuff at all.
There's limitations, but the answer is yes. And think about this. Usually, what if we could aid Eric, who's on the front lines of an actual negotiation and a deal, which is an art unto itself. But what if we could arm him with something tactical like a video that hypes up not only what the company's doing, but where the company's going to go? And what if we actually theorize that if buyer X, which is 100 times bigger than the company that they want to buy, has that much more resources to pump into their acquisition, what if we served up the brand and marketing campaign as if they had already bought the asset? and showed them where they could take it in the future as really a runway or roadmap that's already been figured out for them to a lesser degree, not perfect, but gets their ideas popping in their head like, oh my God, these guys have really thought through not a one directional sell to for us to buy, but a truly win-win where buyer and seller win together. And I think that's what everyone's after.
Mm-hmm. I love it. Eric, how about you? So like when you think about building that roadmap, that forward-looking vision, what does that mean from your role and your perspective?
So again, the best case scenario for me is for someone to come to me and say, I want to sell in 3 years, not in 3 weeks, right? So and that's a perfect scenario, never happens, but the roadmap is just like talking.
That's good to hear, because your world.
It's happening now because I started doing this four or 5 years ago, focusing on companies doing 1 or 2 of revenue, knowing that they were to sell in a couple of years, hopefully I'd be an advisor along the way, which I'll answer your question this way, that when they go to sell, they'll just pick me. So it's working now, but it took a long time. But the roadmap is that you want to get in front of a client when they want to sell in 3 years. Okay, great. Let's make sure that we set you up in a tax efficient manner. That way you're not giving half to the IRS when you sell. Let's make sure you have trust set up for your kids for tax advantages. Let's make sure you've got the right legal documentation in place and done all the legal diligence. That way, when the buyer goes through legal diligence, it's just a check the box. There's no hiccups. Any sort of pending lawsuits, potential lawsuits, let's get that out of the way now. So you do a lot of prep in advance to make the sell process easier because you've done it yourself, Ryan. Selling a company is unbelievably difficult, unbelievably time consuming. And that's in a perfect situation. It's still hard. So I want to get in it with experts in advance to make sure the company's ready for sale. And now with Ted is that, again, this just hit me during our prep today before this call, is that Ted can come in and help me as a banker help my marketing. I write a sim. He can polish it up a bit. He can have it focused towards this buyer, this buyer, this buyer. He can build great campaigns. When the buyer flies in to meet the seller and we're in a room, have one of Ted's kick-ass videos about, like you talked about, and underneath with me and your infrastructure, we'll do this, we'll do that, and the buyers get excited. That's important. One more thing, though, too, that just hit me before, and I know Ted does this, I didn't think about it, is that if I'm going to go to market in a year, I can start pinging the potential buyers now with ideas. Just, hey, look at this, at this. What about you buying him? Hey, and that's getting them excited, right? That just hit me this morning, and I'm sure Ted always does it anyway, but I didn't even think about that. So again, I want to prepare and the blocking and tackling, but it's the things that are the soft things that are the most important. That's what increases value. I'm just trying to keep from getting sued and detract value. What Ted does actually helps increase value, increases the marketing process, increases interest, and I do my job and run a competitive process to increase purchase price.
I think to date, the sale of the business and the sale tools to sell a business have been in isolation. A one pager, a sim, other tactical tools to sell the business and encapsulate the story. One of the other bigger differentiators that Eric and I are pioneering is, imagine if it's not just in isolation, the story is not in a vacuum between buyer and seller. Imagine if the story and the presentation and the pitch is the entire brand in real time, present day. When you make that jump mentally and you say that we have engineered and positioned the brand to find the perfect intersection between selling to customers and selling the entity to a buyer, that is a completely different strategy. It's a different marketing spend, and it is the keys to the castle of unlocking maximum value.
And I want to love it. And I also think that there are a couple comments on that is like, you're really integrating strategic planning with marketing to position the company where you want it to be. And like, just to kind of tie in a couple of the other episodes is that if you have decided to sell to a third party, which is what we're primarily talking about here, is how you're going to be building your company would be different. Like, I'm just going to make an example of when we had our business, we spent like $500,000 rebranding our logo and doing all this stuff, Ted, that essentially you would be kind of facilitating that kind of strategy. However, we didn't get any bang for that buck when we sold because we had built out a lot of infrastructure and a lot of brand stuff that wasn't necessary because of how the sale went through. It was a lot of redundancy. So I didn't get the return on that. But when you're talking about positioning the company and the purpose for the deal, you're trying to make it a reason why that person would want to buy it as is. And I think my point, I guess, is that how people invest in their company, knowing that they're going to sell to a third party, and here's the thing that we're trying to do intentionally, it's going to dictate a lot of your investments in the company over the next year or two. So that way you don't do what I did, where you spend a bunch of money not knowing that you're going to do something like that. So I think it's crucial because you've got the eye out, when you said that intersection between the two. And from both your guys' perspectives, let's talk about why buyers buy. So like, Eric, let's start with your perspective and your career history of like, so a buyer comes to you and says, here's the kind of company I want or why I want this. Like, what are the reasons that you hear? And then Ted, I want to take your side of like from the marketing strategy side, what you're hearing from buyers as well. So does that question make sense?
I want to ask just further clarify. So you're saying, what if a buyer comes to me and says, Eric, I am looking for these 10 characteristics in a company, go find me one? Or is that what you're asking?
Yep. Yeah. Well, because or whether you're representing a seller or buyer, you're hearing the chatter of why buyers are going to buy. So the investment bankers usually hear a certain set of characteristics, like you said, versus like in Ted's world, it's a different type of characteristics from what I'm guessing. And we can talk about that. But does that make sense?
Yeah. Maybe Eric, I think what Ryan's also saying is like, sometimes things are on trend. Certain categories we're working on together now, things are on trend. People have an appetite for a certain set of criteria.
Well, and correct, Ted. And also, Eric, it's almost like it's a lot of financially driven. They're like, hey, this kind of multiple, this kind of size, it's a return on investment. I don't know if CFOs are coming at you or private equity firms versus Ted in an example. It could be like, whatever strategic reason when our company is trying to grow. I don't want to assume anything, but that's kind of what I was getting behind it. And Eric, I'm assuming the characteristics of things that a buyer might want or be telling you might be different than Ted.
That's correct. Except for the last one, which I've just learned with Ted over the last year. So again, growth. And things will fluctuate over time, depending on market conditions, inflation, no inflation, recession, whatever it might be. But there's certain things over time that are going to be static and always going to be in vogue. So growth is very, very important. People want to buy for growth. If you're not growing, what's wrong? Something's wrong. So maintain growth. Also maintain growth, and it depends, in certain sectors, but also maintain growth without losing profitability. Now, I could make cases where I can grow top in certain instances, like maybe CPG goods, where it's a brand in beverage where you can grow top line, who you don't really care about profitability. But that's, for the most part, grow steadily and steady each and every month, year over year, month over month. Try to maintain your gross margins or increase your gross margins. Also, do you have a good product that's going to be, you have a good product or service the market wants, right? Is there a market for it? So I might have a very good product. It's the best of the best, but my TAM, my total addressable market, is $100 million. Well, that might not be worth going after it because that's very limited. So It's a good brand or a good service, a good product, a good addressable market, and then a management team. Because you can have a fantastic idea, a fantastic concept. If you don't have the people internally to run it, it's not going to go anywhere. That's super important too. Like, I'll sell companies now where Ted and I are selling one right now, working on one right now together, and the seller wants to leave. That's an issue. Why do you want to leave? If it's so valuable, then don't leave, stick around. And if so, when you leave, who's going to run it? So those are a couple of things that are in every single deal. And the last one, well, there's many, many more, but the last one I'll talk about is Rojas. So I never, in my own personal underwriting, I never cared about Rojas. I mean, it's important, but okay, who cares? Now it's so...
Rojas, you're actually losing me on that one.
Return on advertising spend.
Okay.
Before, that would be I'll look at it at some point in time. Now it's one of the first things I look at, because buyers are, every dollar you spend, where are you spending it? And what's that return on marketing? It's unbelievably important. And that's where Ted really comes in.
Yeah. And that's really true of like certain businesses, like subscription-based companies or companies in certain categories. I also, just on basic level, why buyers buy, sometimes they're buying because they want to move faster. Buy versus build. Sometimes they want to block a competitor. Sometimes they just see it as a catalyst to something new or better. And sometimes they see it as innovation. Like, maybe they're injecting 50 cc's of innovation into their static company by buying a more innovative, progressive company that, re-energizes the machine. There's a million reasons why buyers buy. I think the beauty of it is with Eric's brain and expertise, he can provide usually the common set or the a logical beginning set of buyers and explain all the different nuances of what they might want. And we can interpret mm-hmm. that and find the red thread throughout to help him co-sculpt what the positioning of the brand and what the brand's message should be. And I'll give you just one other conceptual thought that I've mentioned in the book and mentioned to you before. And you mentioned investing in rebranding and logos and the like. The last thing branding for buyout is painting the house or lipstick on the pig. That's a part of it. I don't disagree. And I think if you have a ramshackle house that's in a good location and you paint it and you stage the house with nice furniture and you bake the cookies so it smells good, people are going to spend more money on that house. But the buyer don't want that house. The buyer wants the blueprints for the condo community that that house can become. And mm-hmm. I think that that's the real juicy part of the future forward thinking of any business and brand is get out of your own mind and your own backyard, put yourself in the buyer's shoes and live there and wallow around for a while. And don't just have a myopic view of you. A win-win is really where the magic happens and the multiples happen.
Well, and Eric, you had something to say that I see you leaning forward.
No, my answer to my questions were, I was saying what buyers look for when they're making an acquisition, but Ted touched on some much better points, why they actually buy, like making sure that my competitor doesn't have it, or what I can do with it with my infrastructure, or, you know, there might be roll-up strategies where you buy a private equity firm, buys a platform company, there might be a minimum of 10 of EBITDA. Add-ons, there's no minimum. If it's synergistic and it can add value to the platform, they can buy it for 5 times, but this is worth 10 times. That's multiple arbitrage right there. So I was trying to clarify that. I was talking about what they look for.
Yeah, yeah.
I went much deeper in a different direction, in a very good direction.
Well, and it's perfect. And that shows the synergistic nature of your guys' roles because, like, I mean, when we call it like in the training that we do and then in this mini series, it's like there's the intrinsic value, the risk of the cash flow. But then there's the reason that a buyer might buy a company or really just an asset that they're going to plug in to their machine is different than the value. There might be a premium above and beyond the financial value. So, like, you know, for example, like, okay, what's a trailing 12 months of EBITDA of this? And like, we're going to do multiple arbitrage. Well, that's I see that a lot in the investment banking and that, you know, when the CPAs are involved, Ted, you mentioned this in your book, it's a lot of the spreadsheet talk all about financial growth, but then there's the why behind it, which is why are they buying the business? And it at the end of the day, and this is Eric, I'd love you to comment on this is like, you know, there's a multiple of EBITDA, a normalized EBITDA that someone's going to get, and, you know, based on whatever you're positioning for all the reasons that you guys have helped for. But if you tap into that black swan of why the hell do they want this company, it might normalized EBITDA might go through the window because why and what they're going to do with that company might be far greater of value with this new entity that they're buying than just the trailing 12 months EBITDA. And so, like, I see the combination of both you two working in conjunction together to find that reason and use that as leverage to maximize purchase price. And so, Eric, I don't know, you know, when you think about like your perspective, how to connect those dots and how to figure that out with the buyer so you can place that value to them and looking inside their minds, how do you guys go about doing that to figure out what the value would be for that buyer from a financial perspective?
Fantastic question. That's a wonderful question. And that's how you get the true outsized value, right? If you have an industry, these buyers are smart. They know that, okay, this industry trades for 8 to 12 times or 8 to 10 times based on growth, based on margin profile, based on ROHS, all this kind of stuff. They're going to be in that range. And most of the buyers, the educated mm-hmm. ones, are in that range. The outsized multiple, the 12, 14, 16 times, that comes from what you're talking about, where what Ted does, where what I try to do, and I'll do more with Ted's help, is that you get the buyer to realize, okay, this is worth intrinsically, or, you know, based on comps and valuation, you know, the financial analysis, it's based on this. However, I can make it worth this times 4, times 5, times 10 in my infrastructure. That's one way to look mm-hmm. at it. Or they can say this is, I'm in this industry and I could do a lot with this. However, they're so good at this. If this competitor buys this, I am screwed. I am fucked. I am gone. They're going to take this and I'm out of business. So I'm going to buy it as a defensive measure. That's one way to look at it too. But again, I think that's where it comes down to. How do you prepare for that? You plan with Ted. Ted and I get in a room, his team, my team, far in advance. We're doing it right now. I don't think we can talk. We can't talk about it. We're doing it literally right now. Ted's taking a company to a whole new branding campaign for us to sell in 6 to 9 months. We're getting in the room. We literally got in a room in Maine a couple of weeks ago and really hammered things out about this, about that. Let's his expertise, my expertise, the client's expertise together, come up with a really good campaign to make this one heck of a marketing process. We're doing it right now. And I've never heard anybody do it in my entire life. It's the first I'm hearing that a banker would do it with a marketer.
Because like, I think about what's left if it's done separately. And Ted, this is what resonated with me from your book, because I remember sitting there going, I mean, every entrepreneur I've met can tell one hell of a story about their company, where it could go. But then the next follow-up question is, prove it.
Right.
So like, you know, Ted, you got the great story. And Eric, you got a bunch of numbers. And so someone could look at the numbers, but then say, tell me a story. They could look at the story and say, then prove it.
Let me fuse the two, because that's what you're
going to say.
You're asking. And I'll tell you, the single word I always think of when you ask the question, why buyers buy, 9 times out of 10, or maybe 99 out of 100 times, I would use the word, they're buying potential. That's what they're buying. They're buying potential. How big the potential depends on the numbers, story, it's everything integrated. But I'll give you an example building off what Eric said as a very specific way to fuse the story, which maybe could be conceived in that context, pure perception versus the numbers, which is hard reality. The fusion of the two is, and this is a practical example, in certain categories or in any category, if you test something, and that test proves that you very well might be opening up a new revenue channel, that could be really appealing to a buyer. So I'm gonna break it down a little bit further. If you're in a particular market, and let's say you're hitting on all the normal channels, but maybe you've never tried DirecTV, and for a low cost, you can try DirecTV as a test, whether it's linear or CTV or whatever, and that shows a spike in sales. And that spike in the sales becomes a use case or a test case that if you only spent $150,000 and that test yielded some really big opportunity, well, what if you're the buyer and you put $10 million into it? That can open up $100 million of opportunity in short order. Just the company that is selling doesn't have the horsepower to go all in, but they're smart enough to say, and by the way, Mr. Buyer, Mrs. Buyer, here's 5 pilots we have going on that we think could yield maybe an additional 100 million, 50 million, 500 million, whatever. That's part of preparing to sell. That's branding for buyout meets the best of investment banking, because we're showing the potential of what it's worth and backing it up with hard data.
Yeah, we're doing it right now. So that's a perfect example. You can tell a buyer in your sim, I've got these 5 growth avenues. I might do this. I might do this. Okay. You might do it. Well, I'm not going to pay you for that, because I'm going to be the one paying for it. So, however, there is you can say, well, I'm actually doing it now. As Ted said, I'm doing it. My budget is X. Your budget is X times 10. I've only got this much capital, but I'm proving to you I'm doing a little bit here, and I'm measuring it, a little bit here, and I'm measuring it. So if in fact I spend X and my return is X times 10, then okay, great. If I spend the more, then it's gonna garner more of an upside. And I model that in. I take what Ted's doing and these different marketing channels and the return, and I put that in my financial model. And I say, we've shown you it works. It works here. Now, based on these metrics, I'm gonna grow it to this. It's based on fact. It's not just some pie in the sky BS. I'm actually doing it. With your budget, I'll do it a lot more, and your expertise. And that does add value to the overall process.
Yeah. And Eric, are you building projections then too? Like you guys are saying, so here's the story, by the way, here's the projections. If we had this kind of investment, this is what it could yield. So that way they don't steal the thunder of saying because essentially you're saying all we're missing is the capital and the partnership to do that. I mean, are you taking the stories and the performance and forecasting that out in order to tell the story together, or is that accurate?
Most definitely. So yeah, that's a great question. So my sims are going to be the typical overview and all that kind of stuff. My financial models are extremely detailed. I'm talking about extremely detailed on the revenue build and the expense build, and we projected out 3 years.
Okay. So then in that same, that was a perfect example about how you're testing marketing to then accelerate that brand. And Ted, in one of your, either the book or the podcast that we did together, you had a great example that I think a lot of business owners, like their first, when they think about selling their company, this is really where they go, is like this one company, like, well, I'll just use my old example because it's just too easy. Like we sold and we did everything besides telecom. You know what I mean? But like we had a couple thousand, 2,000, 3,000 customers, like naturally someone else could sell telecom to that. Or like you had talked about one corporate dev guy that was out buying companies. He had lost a couple of sales or like a potential buys, but like he had some new product or service he needed and it became emotional. He's not looking at trailing 12 months of EBITDA. It's, you know what I mean? So, and so Eric, are in that situation, you're going back with between both you two and saying, okay, here's what they could do with this bolt on or this acquisition in building out the performance and then telling the story as well. I'm just trying to think of like, because that's where that outsized, I mean, you're tapping into the emotion or the strategic plan or the future growth that buyer is going to have, not relying on the entity by itself. I don't know if there's a question in there, if that makes sense, or you guys have got experience with that.
You're nailing the industry. I mean, again, if you think of things in silos, you've had the silo of people saying, here's the intrinsic value, here's the math that dictates the multiple. A really innovative guy like Eric also spins up some ways to show future value. And over here in another silo, we're affecting the brand at its best, tell the best possible story. And when you fuse those things together, it's different alchemy. I mean, it's a different process. And I'll even say, I would argue you change the marketing spend, because typically you want to keep spend down, right? Before you sell, you want to see the growth curve going up. And we're running this bimodal track of keep selling, keep showing growth to the customers, but how do you tell the story to the buyer? And I would also say that there's arguably a lot of things not to do. There is a company that I mentioned in the book and that I can mention because I have, it's an older story now, but a company called Embotix that had tried to sell twice unsuccessfully was convinced that they should change their name. And their CEO is like, Ted, I need you to vet this. Should we change our name or not? And I'm like, after doing our diligence, no, you shouldn't spend $500,000 and change the name of your business because no one in the US is going to buy you. We believe that it's going to be an international buyer because they had already tried to sell twice unsuccessfully. We had a thesis anyways that that would be the case. They're acquired by a Swedish company called Snow, but they actually didn't spend on changing the name, which saved them a bunch of money and allowed them to deploy it into other areas. So it's not just about like spending and testing. It's also about what not to do to make sure that you're making the smartest decisions you can as a brand.
That's fantastic. And that pretty much sums up exactly what we shouldn't have done too. This is about close to the same dollar amounts too. Yeah, that was not worth it. Zero return on that. And so now I want to go back to like, move us forward to when you're sitting down and you're now getting to the, like the story's been told, you're looking, you know, you're kind of mapping out the financial picture, you're mapping out the branding picture, and you're going to be sitting down talking about negotiating EBITDA and deal structure. And like roles, I mean, there's all, I mean, how, thousands of things that people have to negotiate. How are, like, maybe starting with you, Eric, how does what you're doing impact how you show up at that deal table and you're, you know, crafting the LOI, crafting the purchase agreement, and you're having to deal with ad backs and the deal structure and the lever and the negotiation points?
That's another very good question, Ryan. So one of the biggest things is doing a quality of earnings report, a Q of E, ahead of time. So Ted and I right now, the same client, we advised him, the client, and it's, you know, it's 70 plus million revenue. It's big. Do a Q of E, a quality of earnings pre-deal. So that way, when I'm at the table and I'm negotiating with the buyer, my ad backs, it's already been verified by a third party. So they have almost no leverage to cut me back. They can't say, nope, this is wrong. Nope, this is wrong. Actually, no, it's correct. We paid $60,000, $100,000 to make sure it's right. That's one thing. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. And then let's take, absolutely. That's a great foundational point. And then to the next point of, Because I'm thinking about when I was sitting down and we were negotiating the essentially the strategies of like, I know you don't need these things in my company. Because like in the, one of the in the previous conversation, the previous episode, you know, in a financial buyer, you can't, there's no redundancies, right? So if the intrinsic value is not what you need it to be, you can't gut the company and sell it to an ESOP. Impossible, right? So then, but you're sitting there because if you know what you, why the buyer wants to buy you and what they're planning on doing with it, how does that impact how you're positioning or teeing up what those add backs should be? So you start with the Q of E, but then do you take that another step further to say, hey, you don't need my management team or you don't need these things or, you know what I mean? Like it kind of changes the dynamics of the add backs.
I do that. I actually do that. So if I sold two very large fertility platforms, right? And so we put together an analysis of one fertility platform that had the basics in there, the accounting and the ERM system and these other things that, you know, that HIPAA compliant companies have to have. Well, that's redundant. So I built that into my model where you've got buyer, you've got seller, you take out the costs that are redundant, aren't needed. And you actually can increase like your marketing spend based on less marketing spend here, but overall synergistic makes it worth more. I absolutely do that and show it to a buyer where you should spend. And by the way, they're going to use this. If they do, in fact, want to spend 12 times for something, they're going to use my analysis sometimes to make it look like they spent 8 to their buyers, mm-hmm. right? So mm-hmm. they actually appreciate when you point that. They're going to do it themselves, but they appreciate that you've also taken a look, knowing the company very, very well internally by looking at it for 1, 2, 3 years and doing all the modeling for them. I project this model based on what I know. They appreciate that because they're going to use that to their advantage when they talk to their investors. So I absolutely talk about synergies and redundancies. And we, again, very, very detailed.
You love it. And you touched on a point that I want you to clarify a little bit more for the audience, which is when it looks like, so it looks like they're spending 8. I know what you mean, but like, so I don't know if you want to, how you want to start that, but if it was 12 and now it's 8 based on the synergies, can you explain a little bit further what you mean by that?
I can. Again, you might hear, yes, it's a great question. There's a couple of examples. On paper, if something is worth, let's just say unadjusted, you know, audited, it's 10 times, it's got 10 million of EBITDA. And I paid 10 times for it. So I paid $100 million. You won't often see that in a private company. You'll never see that. But behind the scenes, that's exactly what they paid for. However, if they can actually show that they've cut costs dramatically or they've increased revenue dramatically. So if actually they're paying 10 times 10 for a company, it's actually 12 of EBITDA on paper, not 10. They've mm-hmm. just lowered their purchase price. So I'm not paying 10. Now I'm paying 8.5, not 10. They justify that.
Thank you. That was absolutely beautiful because that ties in right to the previous two episodes that we were doing where that's how someone can maximize purchase price, but the buyer doesn't feel like they're overpaying, right? Like, so that's how it happens. So you go for it. You're going to say something?
That's exactly correct. And again, private equity firms have to justify what they spend to their LPs. So they can say on paper, again, I'm buying something at 10 of EBITDA. When I cut all these costs out, it's 12 of EBITDA. So I just paid 8 times, 8.5 times, not 12 times. And it's actually, it's some of it's financial engineering. Some of it's also very realistic and very believable and very applicable. It will come out in 12, 24, 36 months. So.
Well, and what you just hit on, and Ted, I wanted to teed up to you because I saw you chomping on the bit is, yeah, it sounds like, you know, it's not just fake because you're telling the story. So Ted, this is where like, because someone can sit down, of course, if I'm selling my company, I'm like, by the way, you don't need all these things. The next thing you're going to hear is bullshit because they're not going to want to pay, you know, right? They're not going to want to pay you for that premium. But this is where the story, what you're doing is so important. So how does your role play into this?
Well, from the actual negotiation standpoint, I'd say not at all or limited because, or at least not.
I meant the story. I'm not specifically sitting at the deal table. I'm talking about like the work that you're doing in the midst of that conversation we're just having.
Maybe this is a tangent, maybe not. But what I find interesting
Go
is
for it.
A lot of brands and portfolios, private equity portfolios that are stalled or laggards or underperforming. Or even I think they refer to them as zombies, Eric, if they've been around 6, 7 years and the limited partners, the LPs, they want to return on their investment and they want to sell some of these brands in their portfolio. But what I see time and time again is the brands, back to inherent value, the brand themselves have a story that's waiting to come out and be told. It's just being told really poorly. And whether it's in a saturated market, B2B or B2C, you know, often people get into a copycat mode where markets really quickly become homogenous. Literally, I could look at 10 companies and every single one of them, more often in tech, are saying the exact freaking same thing from website to website to website.
They've all attended the same webinars.
Yeah, talking about an opportunity. And also, again, no one in my industry has the, that I know of anyways, has the understanding that not only have to keep selling to the customer, but the buyers are looking for something very specific. And if you can position the brand so it works for both, then you have a higher probability of getting to the negotiating table. And I would also say that one other area of influence from negotiation is creating competitive tension. That you can absolutely do from a marketing standpoint. You can either market against someone, or get into their kitchen, if you will, with marketing. You can also digitally market to potential buyers and make sure that you're front and center, and that you know they're not the only one.
Well, and I think about how you guys the angles you guys both just took. You can tell this great. You can go find the, you know, spectrum of buyers that might want to buy you for the reasons of the strategic reasons you're talking about, Ted. And then you have to build the financial model to prove it. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like it's just one and the same. And it's just like, you have to do this because then you can tee it up and like, you can't just cut everything out of the ad backs or like, you know, plan this out unless you actually can show how it's going to fall under the financial statements.
Yeah. I got one.
So it's funny. Based on this conversation, you can see how unbelievably synergistic this is. I can't wait for you to ask us the question, why hasn't it been done before? But go on.
I have one more payoff story because I have I'm a marketer, creative guy by trade back in the day. And like I said, I can't tell you how many conversations I've had where people are like, you play with magic markers. What are you going to do to influence my value as a company? So a lot of friends in private equity and whatnot, and back in the early days of Branding for Buyout, they're like, you know, what are you really doing that's different? And I'm like, well, let me ask you a question. If you tell me that the numbers are the only thing that truly dictate value, what you've also told me is the way you present the numbers in your spreadsheets can increase or decrease the value of a company. And I'm like, wait a second. So what you're saying is you're not fudging the numbers because that's illegal and you'd go to jail for that. But what you're telling me is the presentation layer of the numbers, the way you present the zeros and the ones can increase or decrease the value. True or false? And they say, absolutely true. Well, if that's true, then why can't you take that same sentiment, that perception and presentation of the numbers doesn't apply to the brand and every aspect of communication that comes with the asset at large? It's a apples to apples concept. It's just not, it's not applied. There's always been two, right. There's always been one silo telling the story. And then there's a new silo that's coming to town, which is me and Eric. And then combined, it's really a new category. It's pre-exit branding. It is a new augmented version of the sell side process where everyone wins. Most importantly, the person who built the business is going to unlock new untapped value and therefore allow us to sell a higher value asset where everyone wins. That's what gets us, that's what gets us excited.
Well, and I think about like my own experience and the dozens of people I've been a part of, or like I see all this or hear the stories on the show, and it's like so few times do entrepreneurs understand the numbers like we now teach and we're doing. And again, that was the missing component. That's why me and Pat, very similar to you guys and now our whole team, it's like these entrepreneurs can tell one hell of a story and they know where to go, but it's not just your income statement. It's just like, and it's not just how much you're making in margins. And so Ted, going back to, I keep going back to that story you told in your book. It's like they get to the deal table and they have this great story. And it's like, look at this income statement for the next 5 years. Well, that doesn't mean anything to anybody. And so, I mean, I shouldn't say that because it's valuable, but it's missing a lot. There's a lot more components missing, but Eric, so you have been doing this for 15, 20 years. Why hasn't it been done yet?
So because I'm just honest answer. I'm honest to a fault. Egos, for one thing, and fear of messing up a deal. So time, you hear this over and over again from every banker. Time kills all deals. And it does. Mm. It does. It really does. And uncertainty also hurts valuation and can kill deals as well. If some people don't want to give up the relationship, so, and I don't understand that at all, but they worry about it. Like, let's say if you're going to sell in between now and 12 months, that might, banker might be worried that, well, we bring in Ted now, he changes the entire concept and the buyer decides not to sell. Ted does such a kick-ass job. Now I don't want to sell. That's a big part of it, right? Mm-hmm. No, now he's not going to sell. I don't get a fee. Well, that's disingenuous, but okay, it's possible. Or maybe they change the branding around, it doesn't work, whatever, and it kills the deal. So those are the kind of things that people might think about, but if done properly and done in tandem and done in a partnership for a long period of time, you're gonna win eventually. The idea is, I want to make sure that we're on it together, that everybody wins eventually. It doesn't have to be today. I've foregone deals. I said, don't sell, not today. You're not ready. We'll sell it, but you'll be way undervalued. Let's wait 2 or 3 years. And it pays off. Not always, but oftentimes it does. But it's also good karma. It's being a good businessman. Just do the right thing. So to answer your question, bankers, unfortunately, want to run the process. They don't want anybody else to give them advice, the client advice, listen to me. It all comes through me. That's unfortunately the way it is. That's wrong for the client, right? I don't know what Ted does. I know what Ted does. I can't do it, right? I need that unbelievable, valuable expertise to make the overall value increase. So a lot of people, I like to put the smartest people around the table for the client. Other guys don't want to do that. I want to be the smartest guy. I want to be the general. I want everybody to listen to me. It's all bullshit.
I also just think Eric and like yourself, Ryan, are naturally have innovation DNA. Yeah. And I'm just going to go back to the taxi cab. Nothing wrong. It picks you up. You put your fare in, it gets you to the destination. There's nothing wrong with yellow cab, dollar cab, whatever. That's how we all grew up. Along comes Uber. It's easier. It's faster, and they became the category king of what they built. I fundamentally believe that there are billions, if not trillions of dollars being left on the table or not left on the table, waiting to be had by every business on planet Earth that wants to sell by augmenting the process. And it's ripe for innovation because I believe it hasn't been innovated for 50 years. It's linear, and what better category to enter than one that hasn't been had a whole lot of innovation? You just need a bunch of people who are open-minded to dig in and unlock a whole bunch of new opportunity, including technology and everything else. And at the end of the day, we all know this to be true too. If you're a first-time business owner and you're a first-time seller, you're gonna get shortchanged. Because you don't know how the game is played. You've never been through it before. You don't know what you're doing. And no matter how much you learn and try, you can mitigate that and do better. But the serial entrepreneurs really have figured it out. And we want to help close that gap and unlock more opportunity. And that's the fun part of what we're doing.
Let me add one thing. Don't get shortchanged if you don't hire a good banker.
Yes.
Well, I agree. What's super fascinating to me about the alchemy, I love that word, of both your guys' roles is that, again, entrepreneurs tend to stick so much into the strategy, the story, the stuff that you play, where you play. I know that you're able to take that and expand it a lot, but they can't prove it then. You know what I mean? It's like, there's always this, like, how do I then get to the point? And they run into those walls. And I don't know, Eric, if over the last 15, 20 years you've seen, like, one of my theses is that, I mean, we've been on a 12-year bull run, man. It's like all going straight up. Yeah, we've had some couple of hiccups, but like someone goes to sell and it's like, well, of course. I mean, everything's going up. So the value is continuing to go where now shit's hard. I mean, you got a lot of things to tell the story. How are you doing with supply chain issues and labor issues and how about inflation? All these things that now matter. I think, you know, the reason I bring all this up to your comment, Eric, is that you go in the past, it's like, yep, I want to sell. And it wasn't probably, I mean, yes, there was a lot of work that needed to be done. Not a lot of deals always closed because of all the lack of preparation, but you could still push decent companies over the goal line, where now it's like everybody's going to kind of working harder to do this.
Never been a better time to do what we're doing, ever.
I haven't been around that long. So, but I would tend to agree with you on that. But I also think, Eric, on your point about like the value of bankers, I've tried to describe this, man, because like that's my suggestion. I mean, we didn't use one, and like we, I mean, I got a 311 podcast episodes about why you should not just do all this stuff without. with a blindfold on, but it's how to value the banker. Where I'm like, how do you have any idea how normalized working capital shores up at the deal table? And they're like, what? And I'm like, well, a banker would be quarterbacking that stuff. So I don't know if you have any comments about like how, I don't even know where to even go with it. Cause I just highly suggest that people engage in a process that they're going to a third party, similar to what you guys are. But what I, let's see if I can answer the question or comment clearly, is that when you don't know something, you don't know that you got short-sighted. You know what I mean? Like someone could say, I got 10 million bucks for my business. But like, what if it was worth 25? They just didn't know it. You know what I mean? Versus tax plan, the deal structure, all the leverage. I don't know what is your guys' response when you hear people talk about, or is a comment like that on your guys' role?
I told the surgeon this 3 years ago. I said, I'm a pretty smart guy. I got my MBA and I'm a surgeon. Why do I need you? I said, would you operate on yourself? He goes, no. Well, I mean, again, I mean, I'm being a little bit catty, but you know, it's just, you don't know what you don't know. Like you just said, one of the biggest deal hiccups and killers is working capital and negotiating working capital at the end. So people have, what's working capital? It's how you run your business. It's the bloodline of your business. It's unbelievably important. That's just one thing. I mean, I've had client after client call, tell me, you know what, man, you saved me. Your fee was, by the way, so far worth it was unbelievable. You made 10 mm-hmm. times worth your fee. We do sometimes 20 and 30 times our fee. It's just, so I talked to a guy 2 weeks, 2 weeks ago. I talked to him a year and a half ago. He wanted to raise capital. You might know the brand, $200 million, unbelievable health and wellness brand. They were 6 million in revenue down in San Diego, and they wanted to raise capital. And I walked him through a process. They go, yeah, okay, great. Thanks for the info. I'm gonna do it myself. And I said, You're going to regret this. 18 months later, he calls me. Everything you said, they were right. It took 18 months. They screwed me over. They retraded. The terms were terrible. I walked. I was 18 months. So I told you. It's not that some bankers are shitty and a lot of them are. You got to have a good banker. But if a good banker is there, he's not going to let the buyer play games or the investor play games, hold them to a timeline. He's going to talk about, you know, what working capital is, what true valuation is, what, you know, there's so many things you can do in a deal where you gotta pay for CapEx for so many years, whatever. All that bullshit, I know what to look for, what not to look for. The seller would never know. It's not their fault. They're buried, busting their ass, building their business. They don't know what I do. You should hire a good lawyer, a good accountant, a good marketer, and a good banker.
Well, and I agree with you, and I've only known you for a couple calls, but like, it's not out of being, you know, condescending. It's literally just like, you don't know what you don't know. And like, you know, in the previous episode last week, you know, we talked about, you know, ESOP management bio, how a financial buyer looks at it. I mean, the company's staying as is. The EIN numbers, you know, changing shares with someone else, right? It's not like you don't have a lot of games to play because the cash flow is going to have to return the value to the new buyer, right? Versus like when you're sitting down and you're sitting against, you know, on the other side of the table where you could swing everything so dramatically. I mean, I don't know how many different negotiation points there are, but it's a lot. And it's just not worth it. I don't know why someone would want to do that on their own.
Well, think about a preferred equity investment and a participating preferred equity investment. Most people outside of us have no idea what that is. That could dramatically change the seller's return. By participating in preferred, it's too detailed for this call. Look, it's unbelievably difficult. That's how you hear about these guys and gals have a great business. They sell to a third party private equity firm, and they get nothing in the return of a $120 million transaction. Yeah, it might have been a 3x liquidation preference. So the buyer got paid out everything. What was left over came to the owner. There's nothing left. They get nothing. I mean, that kind of stuff happens. That's why it's so unbelievably important to hire a good banker who knows how to get you through all this crap that could happen.
And then with Ted, then I was gonna say you go from your perspective.
Yeah, I was just gonna give you one other kind of build off of that is, let's say you're the founder of a business, you've been at it for 20 years, you put everything on the line, you've built something valuable, and in the old model, a banker's gonna sell you and you're gonna make 30 million bucks. And in the new model, you're gonna make 40. I don't know how many people, or, and I'd have to defer to Eric on this, I don't know how much the banker is going to care between $30 and $40 million, but that $10 million difference to the person who built the company is generational wealth meaningful. Yeah,
it's $10
million. It's $10 million. But what Eric and I have really found opportunity in is, again, taxi versus Uber. If you can extract that much more value, everyone wins, and it can't work in silos. His discipline and expertise has to marry with ours so that the new model is maximizing the value and the return, and the difference can be life-changing to the person who built the business.
And I want to add to that, it's also, and it's not, when you say everybody wins, it's your guys' role as the seller, but it's also the buyer. I just want to make sure for the audience listening in, this is not to fleece a buyer. This is to connect the dots that are there available for opportunity, right, Ted? I mean, like, that's the story.
All right, I got to go here. Do you know what the victory plaque is often referred to after a deal, like by private equity or others? You know what it's called. What's it called?
Tombstone.
A tombstone. That means it's dead. We did the deal and now it's dead. I'd call it like matchmaking dream scenario.
Come on, marketer, figure. Come on. What is it?
The reality is it has to be a win-win or someone's losing. And, I, of course, we want to maximize the return for the person selling the business, but it's really the win and the multiple if you can prove it to the buyer, both on the qualitative and quantitative side of the value.
My overview of my company, I think it's the very first page of my credo, is that investment banking does not need to be a zero-sum game. One person doesn't have to lose, someone else to win. It doesn't have to happen that way, and it shouldn't.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you have to have someone like Eric to quarterback the process, or you're not going to get where you need to go.
Guys, this is we can do this for a long time, and I'm so grateful for you guys showing up. A couple of questions along with one of them being where you guys can get or where the audience can find you guys. But before I do that, love to know what the word intentional means for you. Name of the show. I think it's obviously ingrained into what you guys are both doing. So I'll start with you, Ted. I don't know if you've got yours memorized from last time or if you got to let's see how witty you are.
I'll give you a new spin on it. Intentional means on purpose to me. But one thing I've learned over the years is it's, like Olympic athletes visualize gold, winning the gold. It's not just the visualizing, it's putting energy into it. And for me, I think that you have to put the hard work into it, into preparing to sell your business, just like Arcona and like your model tees people up to be educated about it. And what Eric and I are doing helps them, enhance their ability to create value. Intentional growth is methodical, on purpose energy poured into what outcome you want to achieve.
I love it. How about you, Eric?
Oh, okay. I'll caught you off guard, but I like it. Intentional growth. it's purposeful. It's having a very clearly defined end goal and striving towards an end goal with your very detailed plan day after day after day until you hit it.
I love it, guys. This has been a lot of fun. And I would add the one component in this too is, with your guys' help over years, us three were talking about how our CFOs could be having you guys not integrated, but having conversations, teeing all this stuff up. I think it's just, there's some components here that the lower and middle market just doesn't have. And I'm so grateful for you guys coming on the show to share your stories, because it's, some of the stories, Ted, in your book are so impactful, but it's like, how do we help the people that have the $10 million businesses that built America to realize all this stuff too? And to be able to get services like yours, Eric, that's not just the up and down the street broker, but like someone that are, given the really good help too. And so for the contact information for both you guys, Eric, where's the best place to find you? Contact information. The same thing with you, Ted.
Yeah, the best place to find me is my website, which I'm redoing, but it's integralcapitaladvisors.com. That's my firm. And my cell is 310. Should I give that or not?
How many do you want people to call you? It's up to you.
Yeah, I do. 310-995-8579. That's my My office line is different, but call the cell and it goes through. It always comes to me. That's the easy way to call me, get hold of me.
Awesome. How about you, Ted?
For Branding for Buyout, brandingforbuyout.com, which is also undergoing a lot of changes, but you can get the gist of it. And there's a contact form there, or thegrist.com, which is the marketing entity on the front end of what we're doing. And probably, well, I'll just say in the month of September, Eric and I are going to be formally announcing kind of our partnership, and there's going to be some new exciting content and entity around that as well, which will be more to come. And hopefully we can get back on your unbelievably killer podcast.
Yeah.
Love it. Guys, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much, Ryan.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that interview with Ted and Eric. I think that there are a lot of takeaways in it, but I want to make sure that you remember that if you position yourself to go to market to a third party and you're selling your company, that the baseline is always going to be the intrinsic value. You can always fall back on the fact that your company is worth X amount based on the risk of the cash flow, and you could do an internal buyout. You could essentially go to an SBA loan and a bank will underwrite whoever the buyer is going to be, because everybody has determined that the company's worth X because of the risk of the cash flow. You could do an ESOP, whatever it is. That's your backstop no matter what. But if you want a third party sale, everything we talked about in this episode is applicable, and you can go into it eyes wide open knowing that you have a plan B, and you can ask for what you want, position your company in the eyes of the buyer in a way that is going to get you maximum leverage for the terms and maximum value, because they can see the future and the future potential and the future value creation with your company because of the reasons that they want your company and why they would want to acquire it. So I hope you took a lot of today's episode. Next week, I'm going to be having a dear friend of mine on the show, Chris Yates, who is the founder of Rhodium Weekend and was the CEO of Centurica. And he's going to be explaining his exit and how he compared two sales. And one of them was a strategic acquihire, and he's going to explain what happened there. And then he compares that against to how he was working with an SBA lender and valuing the company based on the risk of the cash flow, and how a buyer was going to use an SBA to buy his company, and how different that reflected in the terms, conditions, and value. And it's going to be a wonderful way to wrap up this mini series. Thank you so much for tuning in, and I will see you next week.